You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by IBEW Local 1464 and SEIU Healthcare. IBEW Local 1464 reminds all union members to support each other and encourage all workers to buy union and American-made products. SEIU Healthcare, Missouri, Kansas, unites hospital, nursing home, and home care workers across Missouri and Kansas. Workers provide essential care to our patients, seniors, and people with disabilities. We are committed to quality care and fighting for quality jobs for all essential healthcare workers in Missouri and Kansas. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, reporters at the Lawrence Journal World have formed a union. In response, the bosses have hired one of the most expensive anti-labor law firms in the country to handle negotiations. We'll speak to the reporter's union representative, Shannon Duffy, of the United Media Guild, and one of the reporters about their fight for a first contract. Before, ever wonder what the super rich get from perpetuating racism? We're going to talk to Jim Freeman about his book, Rich Thanks to Racism. In the news, Missouri AFL-CIO former leader Duke McVeigh has died, and Kansas City's Asian communities show up in two protests against hate. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. Her first story is Walsh heads already active labor department. Second, what you need to know about gas hazards and a COVID-19 vaccine. And third, OSHA alleges Missouri plumbing contractor exposed worker to unprotected trench again. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, April 1st, 2021. Earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take up a bid by the Republican Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron to defend an anti-abortion state law, which a lower court had struck down, and Kentucky's governor was no longer fighting. Julie Burkhart, a former advisor to assassinated Dr. George Tiller and founder and CEO of Trust Women, a reproductive rights organization with headquarters and clinics in Wichita and in underserved states, had this reaction. This is an alarming and disturbing day for reproductive rights and justice in the United States. By contemplating further restrictions on abortion, we are only contributing to the detriment of women's health in this country. Abortion care in states like Kentucky is quickly becoming essentially non-existent despite being legal in all 50 states. The damage these bills of targeted regulations and litigation has had on women's health so far has been devastating. For years, anti-abortion legislatures have pushed the limits of Roe by keeping abortion technically legal, while at the same time reducing access to critical health care for their constituents. According to a 2020 report from the CDC, the United States' maternal mortality rate lags far behind other countries, ranking 55th, just behind Russia. This is especially distressing when placed in context of a study from the Center for Reproductive Rights, finding that the more abortion restrictions a state has, the worse women's and children's health outcomes in the state are. That the right to reproductive health is a working women's issue and an issue for all families that work is no longer debatable.
Daniel J. Duke McVeigh was president of the Missouri AFL-CIO from 1982 to 1999. He died in Jefferson City on March 23rd at the age of 85. Duke grew up in St. Louis. He attended St. Louis University and was a journeyman pipefitter and member of the Plumbers and Pipefitters Local 562 for more than 65 years. I'm Judy Ansel, and for the first 10 years of running the labor education program at UMKC, Duke was on our advisory board and a great backer of labor education. He convinced then-Governor Carnahan to get the University of Missouri to expand labor education in St. Louis, Columbia, and Kansas City by pumping over $100,000 a year into the programs and create the labor certificate. You could always get an intelligent and informed discussion with Duke on any range of labor policy questions. Duke played a major role in the Duke played a major role in the 1978 fight to defeat right to work in Missouri and showed real vision in building alliances with civic and faith organizations across the state. We asked former Secretary Treasurer of the State Labor Federation, Herb Johnson, for his memories of Duke. He said, "I admired him for many years." He said, "Duke was never one of those comfortable leaders who want to keep things the way they are. He was learned, a voracious reader, and very progressive, always looking for new ways to help low-wage workers and minorities. Duke would listen to your newest idea. He didn't look for reasons something couldn't work. Rather, he asked how it could work." Herb Johnson, who was quite an expert on workplace health and safety, also noted that Duke was a big participant in the National Safety Council. McVeigh was married to Arlene for 47 years. They had 10 sons and daughters.
Last Saturday and Sunday in Overland Park and in KCMO, there were demonstrations led by our local Asian community and allies to protest the upsurge of hate against Asians across the country. The shooting in Atlanta, attacks on Asian-owned business and on individuals in the street, indicate an upsurge in what has been an American tradition since the 1860s when Chinese laborer gangs were brought to the U.S. to build the railroads. Chinese are the only nationality ever to be banned by law from immigrating to the U.S., and of course, Japanese citizens were rounded up and put into concentration camps during World War II. The demonstration on Saturday near the 888 Asian Market in Overland Park drew over 100 people. It was organized by parents who had adopted children from Asia. We interviewed, "I'm a white adopted parent of two beautiful children from Asia. The increase of hate and violence against Asians is really scary. As white people, we're the ones who have to take a stand. We have to dig into our white privilege so that we can save our community and our world. It's important for us to stand up in solidarity with our children and with the Asian American community to stop the hate and violence. Our children are not a virus, and they shouldn't have to hear that on the playground." We also talked to Jackson, who was doing security at the demonstration. He's originally from China and came here when he was 15. We asked him why it was important to demonstrate.
"Well, I think for the past 4 or 5 years, there has been a rhetoric. It didn't start at the beginning of coronavirus. There's always been a rhetoric. He is the one to blame. And then corona really just triggered it. So I think we, as American society, a lot of times think Asians are foreigners. It doesn't matter people who were born here or people actually immigrated from China, from Japan, from Korea. And then there are a lot of, discriminations. It doesn't matter systematically or it doesn't matter just like a lot of times people, communities are not the community that always like speaks out, not that like the other communities. So a lot of people think, oh, you know, this is that for the Asian community to stand up united. This is not like LA or New York. We have a lot of like, you know, congregated Asian, like Chinatown, for example. You know, your neighbor could be a Chinese, it could be a Indian, you know, it could be from anywhere.
Right. There's so many different Asian cultures here. Is there much to identify one with the other? Because, you know, like Indian culture is so different from Chinese or Korean. Is there any real sense of solidarity among Asians?
Yes, I think so. From the recent event, I think that's the case.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Well, this is Joyce McCauley, and I would like to... just comment, yeah, money does kind of make the world go around. I think that there's a lot of policies and ideas that get embedded within our society that we're just learning about that is based on the money. We want to thank Jim Freeman for coming to talk about his book, Rich, Thanks to Racism. Jim Freeman directs the Social Movement Support Lab in the University of Denver, which works with communities of color across the U.S. to dismantle systemic racism and create positive social change. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School and the University of Notre Dame and was an editor on the Harvard Law Review. He served under President Obama as a commissioner on the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans. Again, welcome. And we're so pleased to have you here. The book is really interesting, and it's one of those documents that I think you can read over and over again and get something new out of it. Early in the book, you talk about the overwhelming majority of harm from modern day racism comes not from individual bigots, but from the policies and systems that shape our lives. Can you elaborate on this a little bit? And how do the policies get embedded within the educational system? And what kind of policies are we talking about?
Sure. And first of all, just thanks so much for having me on, Joyce. I really appreciate it. And really what I was talking about there in the book was systemic racism, right? Which we might think of as the policies, practices, and systems that produce and sustain racial inequity. So, you know, this is the type of racism that isn't as obviously repugnant and disgusting as the individualized discrimination that we still see far too often, but it can be just as damaging, if not more so. Right, while affecting far more people, you know, tens of millions of people, in fact, just in the United States. So, you know, as one example within the education system, how we think about this is that, you know, youth of color are routinely undereducated in the United States compared to their white peers. You know, every year we can see this, we can see these racial inequities and what we call the achievement gap and high school graduation rates and college attendance rates and all these other indicators. And every year the consequences of those inequities are felt very deeply and painfully in families and communities across the country. Yet no more than a tiny fraction of those inequities can be attributed to any explicit racial biases held by individual adults within the system, right? The much larger problem is how collectively we've simply failed to create a level playing field for youth of color. And the same types of dynamics play out in criminal justice and immigration and lots of other areas. So to put that another way, you know, we know for a fact that entire communities of people are going to be severely harmed by these systems every day, every month, you know, every year, that racially inequitable outcomes will inevitably occur based on how these systems have been set up. And yet we demonstrate virtually no collective urgency to fix them. And that's really why I wrote that, because that in a nutshell is the most pervasive form of modern day racism. We have become far too willing to implement public policies that inflict needless harm on large groups of people of color, and far too unwilling to address that harm appropriately when it becomes apparent.
One of the things that you discuss is the onset of the charter schools and the idea of privatizing education. and I'm a public educator, so of course I'm not happy about the privatization that's entered our system. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about the New Orleans experiment after Katrina, when there was so much damage and they were talking about rebuilding. They had not only they had all the infrastructure to rebuild and all that, so that they went to a charter system. And a lot of times our parents do hear, when I talk to parents, they hear that, well, maybe the charter school is a little bit better. Maybe it runs better. Maybe they have, you know, better teachers and that kind of thing. I don't hear that as often. They do like our teachers, but it is a concern for them. You know, is it a better place for their child? So how did this quote unquote experiment in New Orleans play out? And what did it tell us about charter schools and charter education?
Yeah. I mean, for some of your listeners who may not be familiar with that whole story, what like you say, after Katrina, what happened was the sort of famous right-wing economist, Milton Friedman, who had come up with this idea of school vouchers back in the 1950s. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that argued against rebuilding the New Orleans public schools. And he said that the devastation caused by that storm presented an opportunity to radically reform the education system. And before long, really within months, sort of school privatization advocates had descended on the city, and they were really eager to use New Orleans as their laboratory for the types of reforms that they favored. And, you know, at that point, there were already charter schools and voucher programs scattered across the country. But for them, this was their opportunity to take their ideas to scale. And it's worth noting here that, you know, the folks of New Orleans weren't asking for this prior to the storm, and there was no democratic process to do it. They used the storm as sort of an example of, you know, what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism. And eventually what happened is every public school in the city was closed, and New Orleans became the first 100% charter school district in the country. And it became the sort of poster child for the school privatization movement. And they used what they called the New Orleans miracle, really nationally and internationally, paving the way for many more districts across the country to replace traditional public schools with charter schools. Now, as for what the effects have been, you know, bear in mind that New Orleans has been the focus of the absolute best that this sector has to offer, you know, including massive private donations from the ultra wealthy. And even so, it's produced a system of schools that evaluators have found to be highly stratified by race, class, and an educational advantage, where the most rich educational experiences are reserved for the highest tier of students, where students are pushed out and excluded on a regular basis, where the graduation rate is the lowest in the state of Louisiana, where there are these severe logistical burdens that have been placed on families, where mismanagement is severe and widespread, and where there's been really extreme dissatisfaction from the families who, you know, it was said were supposed to benefit from this so-called experiment. So, you know, because, and it's not a surprise, right? Because what this did was, among other things, it eliminated the idea of the neighborhood public school, which if you ask people, they really like. They like their neighborhood public schools. And so I talked to parents in New Orleans who had, you know, 5 and 6-year-old kids who have to take a bus an hour and a half or 2 hours to school and back every day because they have to go across town because there's no school in their neighborhood that they can attend. So they're at the bus stop before 6 o'clock in the morning in the dark, these little children, just so they can get to the school on time. And I talked to parents of students with disabilities who couldn't find a school to admit their child. And I talked to parents of children who go to these new charter schools that report good test scores. But what isn't really talked about is how those test scores are achieved, how their kids are subjected to a curriculum that's dominated by test prep, how kids with disciplinary issues are routinely pushed out of school. And you know, and it, finally, I'll just say that, you know, it's important to note that the school privatization movement, far more often than not, has been done to and not with Black and Brown communities. And in many instances, these communities were robbed of their democratic control over their schools in order to implement these school privatization efforts. And I think New Orleans is the quintessential example of that.
The idea of the test scores, I've been looking at those for like 10, 15 years. And some of the charter schools do have a little bit better test scores than the regular public schools, but some of them really don't. And so it kind of confuses me that, you know, that we still seem to want to put money and resources into these schools that aren't doing any better, and yet taking them from the neighborhood schools. The other thing I want to ask is, how do the charter schools receive this private money, this the gobs of private money, and still also receive public funds? Is that just kind of hidden under the carpet that nobody knows about?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the real reasons why I wrote, you know, this section of the book, because folks don't understand the strategy behind this effort, right? So one thing I did in the book is I looked at just 10 billionaires, individuals or families, who've prioritized this issue. So I looked at Bill Gates, I looked at the Walton family, I looked at the Koch brothers and Mark Zuckerberg and a handful of others. And all I did was track how much those 10 sources contributed to just 50 organizations that have been active in promoting charter schools and school vouchers. There's many more billionaires who fall within the same camp and many more organizations that they funded over the years. But just looking at those 10 sources for those 50 organizations, I tracked $3.2 billion in investments into these organizations. And again, this is just a small piece of the overall effort, but I do think it can provide a sense of how these individuals use their wealth in ways that create an exponentially greater role for themselves in shaping education policies than the parents, students, educators, and community members who are most affected by those policies.
We do have a lot of meetings, town halls, and that kind of thing, where parents are encouraged to come and discuss what they believe should happen, especially when we had some school closures, and you actually noted that in the book. Kansas City had some school closures several years ago. And there were many meetings. I went to several to listen to what they were going to do. I'm not sure whether they had decided already or it seemed like there was some, they really wanted the teachers and parents and families to participate. But I wonder if some of those meetings are held to kind of please everybody. Many, also like maybe town halls that, a city will do, you know, before they make some changes. So everybody come down, we're going to talk about changing roads or whatever. Or is that another place where these ultra rich get themselves embedded, is in those policies where they are saying kind of one thing and then they do another?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. You know, one of the benefits of working on these issues nationally is you get to see how these dynamics play out in different cities. And so I've seen the same playbook being used in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Newark and Chicago and Los Angeles and Oakland and all these other places. You know, the tactics have changed over time. But ultimately they've been very consistent and really steadfast in their efforts. So there's a number of different strategies that have been used over the years. One that's been really noteworthy in recent years is how they're using their wealth to influence elections. You know, for a long time, yeah, School board elections used to be, you know, very low key, low budget affairs. Not many people even paid that much attention to them. Now, you know, there are billionaires who are pouring in hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars into school board races that are strategically important to their agenda. So, for example, if you look at the 2017 Los Angeles Unified School District Board elections, school privatization supporters spent nearly $10 million to win control of the board there. And among the largest donors were members of the Walton family, Reed Hastings, who's the founder of Netflix, Michael Bloomberg, and these other billionaires, none of whom actually live in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing, you know, we talked about Hurricane Katrina earlier. These folks have really used every available opportunity to advance their agenda. So in the case of New Orleans, it was the storm that allowed them to do this. In Puerto Rico, it was Hurricane Maria. In other cities, it's been budgetary challenges or declining enrollment or, you know, allegedly poor public school performance. Most recently, you know, it's been the global pandemic that folks have been using as a reason to advance this agenda. But in almost all cases, these so-called crises that supposedly necessitate privatization have been largely manufactured and pretextual.
And then as we switch topics a little bit and go into criminal justice, it seems like the same thing is happening there, where they're privatizing prisons and incarceration facilities. One of the things that that I'd really like to discuss is the idea behind what is a crime, who decides it's a crime, and what's to be done about committing the crime. That was really interesting to me because it seems like that is playing out right now. The laws aren't really that well established.
You're exactly right. I mean, you know, we often act like there's only one way to handle crime and public safety, but there isn't. You know, there's a series of choices that have to be made in constructing a criminal legal system, a criminal justice system, as we usually call it. So there's this question of how are we going to define crime and determine where it's happening? Who's going to respond? And what's our response going to be? And each one of those questions presents a choice of numerous possibilities. And together, those possibilities carry a wide range of potential outcomes. And so what we in the U.S. have done is we've answered them by saying we're going to allow for the highly aggressive enforcement of extremely broad criminal laws. And two, we're going to prioritize law enforcement responses to these so-called crimes over many other possible responses, despite the fact that there's a fundamental mismatch between what law enforcement is trained to do and the skills needed to really best address these behaviors. And three, we've emphasized these really profoundly harmful and punitive consequences for criminal offenses, rather than those that would be more effective at holding offenders accountable in meaningful ways, repairing the damage caused by crime, meeting the needs of survivors or victims, and really breaking the cycle of crime. So those are the decisions that we've made that led us to have, you know, both the largest incarcerated population and the highest incarceration rate in the world. And, you know, I call those dynamics the criminalization trap, because we didn't have to criminalize people this way. We chose to. You know, in other words, our current system of mass criminalization and incarceration isn't an accidental consequence or an unfortunate side effect. It's the system doing what it was designed to do. You know, with the policies and practices that we have in place that are harming communities, and particularly communities of color, in some really devastating ways, those policies could not have produced anything other than the vastly oversized, overbroad, and destructive criminal justice system, such as, you know, the one we have today.
And the other thing that, and yet somebody's making some money off of this, because if they weren't making money, the ultra rich wouldn't be interested. So I know you mentioned organizations such as the Heritage Foundation, the Reason Foundation, Manhattan Institute for Public Policy. How do they affect what's going on in terms of policy, these organizations?
Well, they've really been the ones driving the agenda. And, you know, one thing I wanted to do with the book was really follow the money behind these policies, look who's driving them, and then who's funding those organizations. So, you know, the sort of right-wing think tanks you mentioned are a great example, been very active over the years in promoting stop and frisk and broken windows policing, this idea of cracking down on low-level offenses, particularly in communities of color, very active in promoting private prisons. And then, you know, another key player in all of these dynamics has been the American Legislative Exchange Council, or they're commonly known ALEC, which has more than, you know, 300 corporate members, which is sort of a who's who of U.S. corporations. And they put out, you know, 1,000 model bills a year in state legislatures across the country. And criminal justice has been a major priority for them. And to give you just a sense of how effective they've been, in just 1 year, one of their harsh criminal sentencing laws was passed in 25 states. So they've been incredibly effective at advancing this agenda. And, you know, and then there are other forces as well that I talk about in the book, like the Koch brothers and others, who have been pouring money into these organizations and advancing this agenda.
Okay, you know, it's just amazing that they have so much power, you know, to affect so many state legislatures. It's not like maybe the Waltons, who are pretty much based in Arkansas, have done a lot in Arkansas. They've done stuff all over the country. And that's what had one of the things that really hit me. We've only have a couple of minutes left. Could you kind of talk about reinvesting, you know, in terms of the prison system, reinvesting into multidisciplinary preventions, the interventions, and those kinds of issues that could maybe stop some of the cycle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I talk about is if we actually designed our criminal legal system in a way that was meant to do what they're actually well equipped to do, that would actually free up hundreds of billions of dollars a year to reinvest in more effective prevention and intervention strategies. So we could use those dollars to address the root causes of crime, including education and living wage jobs, mental and behavioral health care, affordable housing, and things like that. And then instead of making police the first responders to all these public health and safety issues, we could start using all the tools in our toolbox and start really taking a problem-solving approach. So instead of a local police department, what I propose is that we have a local public health and safety department where that police wouldn't lead. They'd just be sort of one spoke within a comprehensive community problem-solving wheel that creates a system of care for individuals, families, and communities, where you have the full spectrum of folks that you need to address the needs in a community, such as social workers and psychologists and substance use counselors and restorative justice practitioners and you know, violence interventionists. And so what we do, if we had that, was really have far more options for solving problems that arise in a community. And we'd be far more effective at it as well, while starting to really address some of this really devastating harm that's been caused by our current system.
Well, thank you. There's just so much to unpack. I wish we had another half an hour, but we're going to have to close out. Again, thank you for coming and sharing. And I just want to recommend this book. It's got so much information, and maybe it'll encourage someone to start some political activism around to make some real change.
Thanks so much for having me, Joyce.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. Earlier this year, an essay published on internet site medium.com about working conditions and union organizing at the Lawrence Journal World newspaper in Lawrence, Kansas, went viral. The author, Connor Mitchell, a former reporter for the paper, detailed instances of what he considered to be editorial bias when it came to stories on race and on sexual violence towards women. He also cited cases of disciplinary actions by management against reporters that he claims only started after the reporters had organized with the United Media Guild. A second reporter left the paper in February, also reportedly not on good terms, leaving just three full-time news reporters to serve a population of over 100,000 people, plus the state's flagship university. Charges of anti-union bias at the paper may have some truth to them, as the Lawrence Journal World's parent company, Ogden Newspapers, who took over the paper in 2016, has hired the notorious and expensive law firm of Michael Zinser to handle their contract negotiations with, get this, the seven-member reporters union. And just to let you know what kind of guy Zinser is, he brags on his firm's website that he successfully argued the case that prevents newspaper delivery boys from legally forming a union. Tell us more about what is happening at the only newspaper in the bastion of Kansas progressivism. Is Dylan Lyson, unit chair for the union, and Shannon Duffy, business representative for the United Media Guild. Mr. Lyson and Mr. Duffy, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks.
Dylan, I'll start with you. The unionization effort happened rather quickly and recently. So when did the reporters at the Journal World start organizing, and what prompted it?
Well, we started organizing last summer, probably around June. There's several reasons that prompted it, but one of them that most obvious to everyone is probably COVID-19. We were called back into the office to work in person in June. And I know several people didn't feel comfortable with that, but we were not asked about it. We were just told to be there. And that lasted for about a week after one of our staff members challenged it. And we've been working at home since safely. But there's been plenty other reasons, including the things that you mentioned from Connor's essay.
Yeah, those charges he outlined are pretty damning. You know, you can't speak for him, of course, but can you corroborate any of the things he was saying, his claims? I mean, it sounds like there was more than just, this is more than just one employee's sour grapes when it comes to particularly the editorial stuff and some of the retaliation issues.
Right. I can't speak to his personal experience. That all happened prior to our formation, but I do know editorial decisions, especially when it comes to reporting on race, has been a concern of members of our union, and as well as just the way management kind of works with staff. I think, you know, there was concerns about discipline and things like that, but just a matter of workplace environment and how comfortable people feel working with management on a day-to-day basis.
Right. So when you say reporting on race, is this editing of stories to change the meaning, or is this, what kind of biases are we talking about at editorial decisions being made?
Well, last summer, especially when I think everyone's aware of the death of George Floyd up in Minneapolis, and the fallout and really the public response throughout the country, Lawrence was no different. There was definitely protests and people demanding change here. And the way those discussions were portrayed in some stories, I personally wasn't writing these stories, but other reporters didn't feel comfortable with how edits of those stories had taken place, and what kind of words we were using to describe people who were calling for change.
Mm-hmm. I see. So is the bargaining unit you guys have is rather small. It's gotten smaller over the past year. What challenges has that presented as a union, or are there advantages to actually having a small unit? I mean, is everyone sticking with the unionization effort?
Well, getting smaller obviously isn't great. We keep losing employees. We've lost four since October, and none of those people have been replaced. Just in the way things have been handled, it's just rearranging who does what. There's at one point I was covering several beats, I would definitely say we're sticking together. I think some people who may not have been very passionate before we became a union have somewhat seen the light in some areas where, with people just not having positions refilled, I think they're now kind of seeing the benefit of why we're here. But as for how bargaining's going, this is the first time around, so I'd have to let Shannon take that one.
Yeah. How do you think? So Shannon Duffy he's the business rep here for United Media Guild. So what's your take on the bargaining so far?
Well, in January, the paper let us know that they had hired the rather well-known firm of the Michael Zinser law firm, and they are notoriously anti-union. So we've been bargaining for about 2 months now, and we do have a few things TA'd, tentatively agreed to, very, very small provisions. So it's proceeding, but we haven't TA'd any major issues. Some of the issues that Dylan was talking about, like how edits occur, and what happens if someone writes a letter to the editor about a reporter, is a reporter allowed to answer that. I mean, there's a lot of journalism ethics questions that we are trying to get into this collective bargaining agreement. So there's some understandable process for managers and journalists both, rather than this constant wondering what shoe's going to drop next. It's still early days in bargaining. We've got a long way to go.
Dylan, I would assume actually having a small union made it easier to organize without management knowing about it. Did management have any sense that the organizing was happening before you announced it?
No, I don't think they knew at all. It definitely, one of the benefits for us, yeah, we were smaller, but also it seemed several people independently had the thought before we started asking around and seeing if people would support it. I remember one of our reporters told me I was like the second or third person to ask her about it before when we started to get going. But I think, they didn't know at all. We announced publicly at the end of September, and I'm sure that was a huge surprise for them.
So, Shannon, back to you. This law firm, Zinser, and then the owners, Ogden Newspapers, I mean, what's your take on this approach? I mean, this is a 7-member unit bargaining group at this point. Maybe it would be 10 if you were fully staffed, right? Something like that.
Right.
You're hiring this guy for hundreds of dollars an hour to negotiations. What do you like of this? Even in this time.
they've got him at the table, and they've got their head legal person for Ogden Media at the table, as well as the publisher of the LJW. So they've got two attorneys, which that's a first for me. So yeah, they're paying an awful lot of money to bargain for this, as you said, seven-person unit. Here's the thing, though, man. I mean, you know, it's never really about money with employers. It's usually about control. And everything we're running up against in bargaining is, well, we have to, management needs to have the discretion to change their mind on this or that. It's really hard to nail them down on agreeing to various rules. They want the option to be able to do as they please, which again is about control. So it's not surprising. It's disappointing. And even with a seven member unit, you're right. They are, it's easier to organize a small unit, but you still have to negotiate a full contract with jurisdiction language, how discipline will work, grievance and arbitration, what the benefits are, what kind of retirement. I mean, it doesn't matter if there's three or 300, you still have to negotiate an entire collective bargaining agreement. So their approach seems to be one, I'm not going to say they're stalling, because as I said, we've gotten two TAs so far, but it's not exactly the most cooperative.
Right. They're playing hardball. I mean, they're playing hardball. This would be the first paper that in the company that would be unionized in any form at all, right? Is that correct? As far as you know?
They bought a paper in Honolulu. Ogden bought a paper in Honolulu a few years back that was already union. But this will be the first one to go union while it was owned by Ogden. So this is the first one they've had.
Dylan, has since the union formed and particularly since negotiations have started, has management's tactics, attitude, style changed towards the employers over what it was like before you guys announced the union?
I would say after the union was formalized, there was about 2 weeks there that things got really rough here, where a lot of concerns came up, where it seemed like management was not only, you know, not working well with us, but was outright aggressive. But, you know, that I don't know if that was ignorance on how to work with the union, especially when we have status quo provisions in place. But ever since bargaining started, I think things have been in the newsroom pretty smooth. I think management has at least recognized how to work with the union on the day-to-day side. But I'm the only one in staff who's been at the bargaining. So I think the rest of the staff is largely avoiding any confrontation that might come from that. So, but at the moment, things are pretty smooth, and we're just kind of happy to keep moving along and keep improving.
I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving, and with us tonight are Dylan Lyson, a reporter for the Lawrence Journal World, and Shannon Duffy, a business rep for the United Media Guild. We're talking about the new union at the, you know, at the newspaper. So Dylan, what are your main demands? I mean, everybody knows what goes into bargaining, but can you kind of tell people a little bit about what you're looking for in terms of wages, benefits, that sort of thing?
Right. We already mentioned the editorial and the way management works with us. But yes, wages and benefits are definitely a big deal. I think everyone knows journalism isn't really a high paying gig, but we definitely think we should be paid properly. And then on top of that, benefits, especially if you're someone with a family and trying to pay healthcare costs through this position is pretty difficult at the moment.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me just say that on the issue of medical coverage, health insurance, Ogden has shifted the burden of the premium care. You know, if it's just you, if it's one person singular, it's not that expensive. If it's you and a spouse, or you and a child, it's through the roof. And the good plan, the 90-10 plan, if you're an employee with one other person, it's like 1900, your share is like 1900 a month. And the employer's share is less than half of that. So the better the insurance, the higher the cost to the employee, not to the employer. It's so if you work at the Journal World and you have children, you can't afford to cover them on what they're paying you. You can't. It's terrible.
I think some of this is all borne out by, you know, the longevity of the staff that you have, right? I mean, Dylan, you said you've been there for only a couple of a few years now. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a kind of job anybody at the Journal World has for very long. Is that correct?
Right. Our staff, the members of our union are all pretty young. I think the oldest are in their 30s. I think I personally want to be here a long time. I love Lawrence. I love this paper, and I want to report on it for as long as I can. But the way things are made or sorted out, you really, if you want a better pay or better benefits, you need to leave, is really how it stands at the moment.
Mm. All right. So this is sort of a stepping stone job, not really a lifelong career, the way it's set up at the paper now.
Right.
I guess we've already asked, you said that you get the sense that management is kind of maybe dragging this out a little bit. Do you think that there's an attempt to decertify the union? Is that what they want to happen? And are you worried about that in any way?
Me personally, I don't know. This is my first go around. Like, as I mentioned, I'll definitely let Shannon answer that question.
No, these are still early days in bargaining, and you can't circulate a decert until a year after the election. We were certified. We were, the election was December 28th, and a couple weeks after that, we got the certification. So, but that is Michael Zinsser's MO. He drags out. And then they try to decertify the union at some point. We're bargaining in good faith, and we will continue to bargain in good faith. We want a contract, but you know, right now the only people standing up for local journalism is the guild. It's not the papers, because most of the papers are owned by out of town owners, right? You don't see local ownership of newspapers anymore. Everyone's part of a chain. And so efficiency becomes, you know, the watchword, right? So everything is bottom line. And jobs are eliminated. Work gets outsourced because everyone wants low costs. Coverage gets centralized and some might say homogenized. And you lose that connection to the community. You know, papers are losing their souls, and in the guild, the news guild is the one standing up for journalism ethics, for local journalism, for good, strong paying jobs. We're the ones, you know, fighting on the side of the angels. We're for communities. Honest to God, there's so many hedge funds now involved in this. It's incredible. And, but the guild, you know, we have people on our side, and we have those people have neighbors and friends, and we're going to get this done.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have, I guess you've seen a pretty good rise in membership. I mean, a lot of reporters at either online newspapers or websites or, you know, are organizing because they see the writing on the wall. This is the last tactic they have left to protect their jobs from being outsourced, you know, wherever. Everything's just, what, Dylan, we've got a couple minutes left. I mean, what's your thoughts on how well the Journal World, what's happened to the local coverage of the Journal World? With three reporters, I can't imagine that you're getting the kind of local coverage that you think you need.
Right. We're still doing our best to cover this community. Obviously, I think it's a, fewer people, fewer people trying to cover the same amount of ground. That's either more work for the same amount of pay, or just it's not going to happen. It's something's going to fall off. But at the moment, you know, we're trying our best. I think this town still cares about local news, especially now in the during a pandemic. Just every day, there's something someone needs to know. You know, we're doing our best. And obviously, if we had those positions filled that we lost, I think we'd be doing a lot better. But, you know, we're still a good paper and we still care a lot about this community.
Well, I hope your management actually starts to recognize that what you guys are worth to them. And, you know, not just the bottom line, but also just the, what it's worth to the community to have a local newspaper that actually covers local news so people know what's going on at their own city council and their own county government and everything else. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you guys for both being on the show, and hopefully you'll keep us up to date on what happens with contract negotiations, and we'll get that out to our listeners.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was Dylan Lyson, reporter at the Lawrence Journal-World, and United Media Guild business representative Shannon Duffy. I'm Sean Saving. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Safety First with Mary Ario is up next.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, Walsh heads already active labor department. From EHSToday.com for March 29th. As the new Secretary of Labor, Marty Walsh takes the helm of the U.S. Department of Labor, DOL. He will find himself running a sprawling bureaucracy that already has been hard at work for months implementing President Biden's agenda while undoing actions taken by the Trump administration. Perhaps the most active part of DOL is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. At Biden's direction on January 29th, OSHA issued a comprehensive COVID-19 guidance document for employers about what they should do to maintain a safe workplace. OSHA also will deliver emergency temporary standards, ETS regulations, for employers any day now and has announced enforcement initiatives regarding COVID-19. The ETS has long been sought by Biden's labor union allies. DOL under Trump had resisted developing an ETS, which was believed to be unnecessary. This new emphasis on COVID-19 safety extends to the Mining Safety and Health Administration, which has also adopted a new guideline similar to the January 29th document issued by OSHA. Walsh stressed during his confirmation hearing that he does not wish to turn OSHA enforcement into a confrontational crusade predicated on the view that employers generally are unwilling to follow safe practices and intends to employ a more collaborative approach. Walsh won plaudits from both the National Safety Council and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Next, what you need to know about gas hazards and COVID-19 vaccine. From OHSonline.com for March 1st. When news broke that the FDA had approved Pfizer's version of the COVID-19 vaccine, the world rejoiced. But on the heels of the announcement, a problem began to take shape. Pfizer's version of the COVID-19 vaccine must be kept extremely cold, a chilling minus 70 degrees Celsius equal to minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, which leads to invisible gas hazards when transporting and storing the vaccine. Due to the extreme temperature requirements for the vaccine, transportation likely requires some form of dry ice. Dry ice, which is created by compressing carbon dioxide, CO2, gives off CO2 as it dissipates. When transported in bulk, this CO2 can put people nearby in danger by displacing oxygen. Low oxygen levels are especially concerning when carrying the vaccine on an airplane. Any potential for CO2 on a plane means it could get into the cockpit, and that could put everyone on board in danger. For truck shipments, where the supply gets broken down from bulk into smaller deliveries, the issue of leaking CO2 is minor but still a present threat. Unfortunately, CO2 can be difficult to detect without the right equipment. To monitor changing CO2 levels when working with dry ice, look for a flexible multi-gas monitor that offers both oxygen and CO2 sensors. See the OHSonline.com article for more information. Finally, OSHA alleges Missouri plumbing contractor exposed worker to unprotected trench again, from OSHA.gov news release for February 18th. Barely 2 years ago, after Aero Plumbing LLC agreed to adopt a comprehensive trench safety program following the December 2016 death of an employee in an unprotected trench, federal inspectors responding to a complaint in August 2020 found another of the company's employees working at least 7 feet below ground in an unprotected trench in Grain Valley, Missouri. OSHA cited the Oak Grove contractor for 2 repeat and 2 serious violations of trenching standards and proposed total penalties of almost $300,000. OSHA alleges the contractor failed to provide basic safeguards against trench collapse, such as a trench box or shoring material, and exposed an employee working in a trench to unsecured electrical and gas lines. After a fatal trench collapse led to an employee's death, Aero Plumbing's owner signed an agreement with OSHA in September 2018 in which he agreed to put in place a comprehensive trench safety program, explained OSHA Regional Director Kimberly Still in Kansas City. Yet, Aero Plumbing failed to implement the agreement. Employers must follow appropriate trench safety procedures and protect workers from serious and sometimes fatal dangers of working in unprotected trenches. Companies have 15 days from receipt of citations and penalties to comply, request an informal conference, or contest the findings. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And this is Judy Ansel with the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for April 1st, April Fool's Day. And I will say that this is the 32nd anniversary of the founding of the Heartland Labor Forum. Happy birthday to us. Also in the calendar, All Souls Unitarian Forum, Stacy Shaw on the front lines of Kansas City Black Lives Matter Uprising. That's Sunday, April 4th at 10 a.m., go to allsoulskc.org to get a link. Help Canvas to renew the Kansas City, Missouri earnings tax. Saturday, April 3rd, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Just email Justin at mojwj.org to sign up. Labor and a Jobs Guarantee, a 3-part online course. The first was today, the second's on April 8th, and the third is April 15th. Learn about a bill that's in Congress and how to fight for it for a guaranteed job for everyone. Go to rosalux.nyc.org. You can find our calendar on our Facebook page where you can find these links. Senator Bernie Sanders speaks to the Kansas Democratic Party Saturday, April 3rd. To register, go to the Kansas Democratic Party website. Support SEIU healthcare workers at Menorah and Research Hospitals Wednesday, April 7th, 3 to 4 p.m. in front of Research Hospital on Meyer Boulevard at Prospect. UMKC Cesar Chavez Memorial Lecture with Yanira Marino, President of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Thursday, April 8th, 6 p.m. on Zoom. Look for it on the UMKC webpage. And finally, the Polk School is going to have a 2-day labor leadership training for women workers, June 24th to 26th. It will be in Chicago, Illinois. You can apply online today if you go to look for Regina Polk Women's Labor Leadership Conference. That's it for the Heartland Labor Forum. Tune in next week. We're going to have Toni Gilpin on the air. She's written a book called The Long, Deep Grudge. It's about the Farm Equipment Union, and it's a fascinating story. And we're going to be talking about organizing Google. That's also a really interesting strategy. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman.
I was too young to see. Now after 15 years standing side by side with working people, sweating for an earnest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.